Morning. I'm John Kraft. I have the honor of being appointed to represent the petitioner, Mr. Scott, in this case. Excuse me. This court has granted a certificate of appealability, and we're here on appeal of the dismissal of the case on procedural grounds from the court below. The argument here is divided really into two sets. There's the first set, which has to do with the convictions arising from a plea of guilty to two counts of unauthorized entry and one count of aggravated burglary under Louisiana law. The second set has to do with a jury trial conviction for sexual battery. The issues are distinct, but both of them resulted in a dismissal from the district court on procedural grounds. With regard to the first set of cases, the argument really has an epigram, a really nice one. Keats said at the end of the Ode to Grecian Urn, truth is beauty, beauty, truth, that's all you know and all you need to know. Well, the Supreme Court, echoing that same kind of reflexive truism, said in Burton versus Stewart, final judgment in a criminal case means sentence. The sentence is the judgment. In this case, Mr. Scott appealed his case in the court below, and it was remanded to the district court for a resentencing. The time with regard to issues regarding to facts underlying the case other than the sentence, perhaps his time began to run with the finality of that initial appeal. However, the sentence was still pending, and the sentence was amended upon appeal, and a new sentence ended, and that's when the time began to run. Article 930.8 of the Louisiana Code of Criminal Procedure makes it abundantly clear that both the conviction and sentence have to be final for the time to file post-conviction relief to run in Louisiana court. It says quite clearly, no application for post-conviction relief, including applications which seek a nine-time appeal, should be considered if it's filed more than 2 years after the judgment of conviction and sentence has become final. Sentence is a necessary part of a conviction and the finality of that conviction. The facts are quite clear. If it's merely the finality of the conviction that counts, we're out of time. For this finality of the sentence, we're in time. The state law is clear.
Can we be clear about this is a federal standard, not a state standard?
Yes. So I quoted
not the state law being.
I quoted that's the state law as to why the state law is conviction, what's final in the state law. And so that's very important because the state law determines when a conviction is final. And I realize that also cites the 2 years, but that shows that's the standard for state post-conviction relief, which is a very tricky thing because it gives you more time than the federal law does. It's a mousetrap that's caught many a poor mouse. But Burton versus Stewart is a United States Supreme Court case, and it merges the two. Historically, what we're talking about with the 2254 conviction is the writ of habeas corpus ad, and there are too many vowels in it, subjugitum, out of subjectivity, out of captivity. And that's what the whole thing is. It's to get you out of jail. If you're not confined, habeas corpus doesn't apply. The parallel authorization for vacation of a judgment of sentence in section 2255 has been found to be inapplicable to people who are no longer confined, even if they're still under some sort of sentence of probation or parole or supervised release or whatever might be going on in that case, because it's the captivity that matters. It's the sentence that matters. And Burton versus Stewart makes that absolutely and abundantly clear. I think the district court was wrong to assume that. And with regard to those issues, this case needs to be remanded so that the merits of the issues can be disposed of. The other situation.
Before you go on to the other issue, have the other circuits who have examined this issue after Burton, they've both, is it just the 10th and the 11th, and they've both held as you would have them hold today? Or are you?
I believe to be the case. And I appreciate the question. The other issue is whether or not he raised claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. The judgment and recommendation that came from the magistrate and was approved by the district court was blunt and said he didn't raise it at all. If you look, though, scanned into the brief is his own language from claim two of his state post-conviction application. The state is correct, the respondent is correct. There was some communication back and forth between the commissioner and the state district judge about whether or not that was sufficient. It was sufficient to get them to talk about it, and it was raised below. Undoubtedly, it can be said that it was raised inartfully, yet it was raised. And it's sufficiently raised for it to be able to go back to the court and for the district court to decide to what extent it was raised and to what extent those issues should be reviewed, but not simply to be summarily dismissed based upon an erroneous conclusion that he'd never brought it up before. So we've never gotten to the issues of this case in federal court. He was not given the opportunity to get to the issues. Counsel was appointed, and we were anticipating the phone call for setting of the hearing, and instead got the report and recommendation dismissing same. So, in all fairness, this man should have his time in court. His time had not run. It's a reasonable reading of the law, a reading of the law demanded by Burton versus Stewart, that conviction and sentence, conviction and judgment go together. That sentence and judgment go together, sorry. That the sentence is, in fact, the judgment. We'd ask this court to remand this case for consideration on the merits. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Kraft. You've saved time for rebuttal. Ms. Chapman? Ms. Chapman?
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. Judge Higginbotham, I agree with you. This is a federal law issue. It has nothing to do with state post-conviction law. While we do look to state law to determine what is a final judgment in Louisiana, we have to look to AEDPA to determine what does the judgment mean in that statute. And that's the first place that we need to look. It's the language. And the language is very important. In both parts of the statute in D1, it simply states the judgment. There's no language about conviction and sentence as there is in Louisiana state court. Indeed, the limitation period shall run, it states, from the date on which the judgment became final by conclusion of direct review. It's at that point that we can look to Louisiana state law, which the district court did, and determined that, in this case, the judgment of conviction on docket number 799977 became final prior to the sentence becoming final. Because in this case, the issue came up on appeal, the appellate court affirmed the conviction, and it's important to note that although they did vacate the sentence and remand, the remand was simply to delete it was a ministerial issue. It was to delete some language attached to the 20-year sentence. Importantly, the 20-year sentence never changed. When it was remanded back, the district court simply deleted the without benefit language and kept the 20-year sentence.
So I don't quite understand that what you're doing with the language in Burton. I mean, how you're dealing with that.
Yes, and when I read that, I was a little, I didn't know what to do at first, to be honest with you. So I analyzed the case. I looked to the Berman decision, which is cited in Burton, which is where the language, the sentence is the judgment, comes from. And I was able to make a distinction in Burton that Burton dealt with a sentencing claim on habeas. In our case, there has never been an issue with sentence. In the habeas petition, everything relates to the conviction. The judgment of conviction is what is important. And in Burton, indeed, there was a sentencing. All throughout, there were sentencing issues. So to me, that's a big distinction. I would also note that the Berman decision on which they took that quote is a 1937 decision, and the context of that quote was to explain to the lower court the difference between execution and imposition of sentence. So the context of that quotation had nothing to do with the issue that that Burton used it for. So I hate to say that they took it out of context, but that's how it appears to me in reading both of the cases. And another thing to note is that the Berman decision was well prior to the AEDPA being passed by Congress. And indeed, if Congress wanted to include the language of finalization of conviction and sentence, they could have easily put that in, but they didn't. So we're left with that, and
you're doing an artful job as an advocate, but I mean, the language in Burton, you know, the federal habeas review, the limitation does not begin until both his conviction and sentence became final. And I mean, even if they're not challenging the sentence, obviously, if you challenge the conviction, you're in effect challenging the sentence, because without a conviction, there's no sentence. So, they both have to be completed, it seems to me.
And if it gets to that point, if you don't accept the first part of my argument, I would argue in the alternative that when the matter was remanded for resentence, that although the First Circuit Louisiana Appellate Court came back and said we affirm the sentence, there was no appellate brief filed in that matter. There was an appeal filed, as they call it, but no brief was filed in Louisiana appellate procedure. That pretty much constitutes an abandonment of the appeal. The First Circuit has the ability to look at just the pleading without looking at the evidence or the record, which is what they decided to do, and they simply affirmed the sentence. But I would argue that no appeal brief was filed. There was no appeal, truly a true appeal of that sentence. And if you look at the sentence, he was resentenced on March 12, 2004, 30 days after, we have 30 days to appeal. If he didn't appeal in 30 days, that's April of 2004, the 1 year would have expired for habeas, filing a habeas petition in that instance. So I would urge
that in your brief.
It's not. It's something.
That's not in your brief at all, is it?
No, it's not. It's something that as I was re-looking through all of the pertinent dates and the procedure, it's something I wanted to raise with the court, and I wanted the court to look at the dates and to look at the specific language of the First Circuit when they affirmed the sentence and when they remanded in the first instance.
Well, I appreciate your efforts, but, you know, the Supreme Court was addressing a very fundamental problem with the habeas, and what they were concerned about was piecemealing of habeas petitions, and they wanted to treat it as a federal law matter. The conviction and sentence of the unitary matter, not allowed to be sliced and bisected. And that principle was a federal principle, and that's why I asked the question, is it federal law? It doesn't matter that the state may treat one thing or another. Our sister circuits, 11th, and the other circuits have applied this to 2254. I just really don't quite get
it. Right, and I understand that, and I agree with you to an extent. I feel that the language of AEDPA and you in looking at state law, Louisiana state, for some reason, allows a conviction to become final prior to the sentence. And it is final by conclusion of direct review, because if an appeal is not taken from that conviction, you can't appeal it. You cannot wait till the sentence you're resentenced to then appeal the issues relating to conviction. And I think in this case it's very important that only issues relating to conviction have been raised. So it's the judgment of conviction, as the district court found, that is the important judgment, and it's the one for purposes of habeas in this case which should be applied. So we would urge that you affirm the district court on that issue. I'm going to move to the second issue unless you have any other questions. The second has to do with whether Claim 2 was procedurally defaulted for failure to fairly present the substance of the claim. And we know that in order to exhaust, you must fairly present, and if you don't, it's technically exhausted, but procedurally defaulted, which is what the district court found in this case. And we look to the state post-conviction application filed by the petitioner. Although he titled the claim at issue ineffective assistance of counsel, the facts that he put in support of the claim don't always follow what they title the claim to be. In this claim, he's actually raising that his right to a jury trial was violated. Within that, he seems to raise a sort of sub-ineffective assistance claim dealing with his counsel failing to prepare. And then after that, as you know, he threw in, and due to an all-white jury selection. My argument is that...
Well, no, February the 12th, 2003, said my rights to a jury trial of my peers was violated.
Yes, sir.
And I was wrongfully convicted due to an all-white jury selection. Now, that certainly puts the legal theory of jury selection before the court, doesn't it? And where the factual basis, it seems to me, is where the problem lies here, not with the, at least for a pro se petitioner, that's a pretty good statement of the...
Well, it doesn't seem, and as the state court commissioner found, the standard in state court for post-conviction is the failure to specify with reasonable particularity the factual basis for relief, which is very similar to the federal standard of failure to fairly present the substance of the claim. And I would argue that the simple statement, and due to an all-white jury selection, is in no way a pattern of facts as required by Kittleson. It's not a fair presentation. It's simply an allegation. If anything, there's no facts in support.
Well, aren't we talking about not specifically the jury selection, but the attorney's failure to handle that in an effective way?
Well, I believe that issue...
That was a friendly question, by the way.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe when Mr. Kraft came on, he fleshed out the issue in habeas more. But in state post-conviction, that's the only thing that we had. That was the only statement that was made in that regard. And I agree with the commissioner's finding that simply was not enough to fairly present, or in state court to reasonably specify the claim he was trying to make. If he was trying to make he wouldn't necessarily have to say he was making a Batson claim, which in state court the attorney would say, and I recognize that he was doing this in a pro se fashion, but simply raising that as sort of an aside does not rise to the level of fairly presenting or specifying with reasonable particularity.
Okay, so we have that the title is ineffective.
Right.
And then he says his attorney is inexperienced in some other word. What did he say besides inexperienced?
He said, I was wrongfully convicted due to same prior ineffective assistance of counsel that was ill-prepared for my jury trial and inexperienced.
Ill-prepared and inexperienced and ineffective, and then the next sentence is, as a result, I got an all-white jury. Isn't that that's the cumulative thing of the all-white jury is the cumulative effect of his ineffective counsel who was ill-prepared and inexperienced?
I believe that could be an interpretation. The interpretation I take, and I believe the one that the commissioner in the district court took, was the fact that he began his argument, or he began his recitation of facts on this as my rights to a jury trial were violated. That seems to be the crux of what he's trying to say. Even though he wrote ineffective assistance, that's what he was complaining about. He didn't get a fair jury trial is what he believed.
Well, the difference between what he said to the state petition, which is what I read to you earlier, last reading, which I think comes from the federal habeas petition. And so is that correct? That's also a friendly question.
I'm sorry.
I was just saying that the statement that I read to you earlier was what he said in his state petition. In his federal petition, he adds to that ineffective assistance, et cetera. But what I was suggesting to you is that the legal theory may well have been sufficiently put to the state court. The difficulty I have with this sexual battery exhaustion issue is whether they were sufficiently put to the state court as a factual matter in the allegation or not, even for a pro se petitioner. And I think that's the question that I have. I don't know the answer to it, and that's what you can help me with.
I think that no, he did not. He did not. There was no pattern of fact. It was one statement. It was It seems to be just kind of added in. It's just an ad. It was just thrown in. There's no facts backing it up, and I think that's what the commissioner had an issue with. That.
Well, procedurally, in Louisiana law, the first allegation with it about the jury trial, he puts that legal theory. What is it required for him under state law to obtain an evidentiary hearing of some sort on that?
On post-conviction relief, it's within the discretion of the commissioner or the district judge. If they feel like the record supports it, if they feel like enough facts have been presented, they have the discretion to hold a hearing if they feel like they need more information. Routinely, the state court will get post-conviction applications that are simply allege that something happened, but there's no support for it. If there were some support, if there were some pointing to the record that the court could have gone to, they could have easily, as you say, granted a hearing to flesh this out a little bit more. But if it's simply an allegation and there's nothing else in support of that, then there is a procedural bar to that, which is what happened in this case. The commissioner said there was not enough. It was simply an allegation, and this is it's procedurally barred for that reason under the Louisiana code, the criminal code. I would argue that extends to federal law as well. The standards are very similar, and there was no fair presentation of any facts in state court. There was no pattern of facts alleged as required by Kittleson. My argument is that.
Well, you tell the state court judge, this is a black defendant, I think. A black man says to the court, I was convicted by a white jury, all white jury, and my rights were violated. That certainly fairly states that what his claim is that the jury selection was improper, which we peremptory challenges used all the kind of things that go with that. But you're saying that he must, in order to obtain a hearing, have offered more facts.
Yes.
When the facts are just the transcript of what happened.
Exactly.
These are not external to the court record.
Yes,
But he's got to point out in the record what the challenges were or what.
Or simply make more than a statement. There has to be more than an allegation. It doesn't necessarily have to point to something in the record, but there has to be more than just I was wronged. There has to be some sort of substance to it to give the court the reason to go look into it more. And in this case, there simply wasn't. And the commissioner decided, and the district court trial court agreed that there wasn't enough. There wasn't enough alleged to say that he was alleging that was enough under post-conviction law in Louisiana. It was not. And I would argue that because of that, it was not fairly presented to the state courts and cannot now be raised on habeas corpus relief to the federal court.
But if he had gone ahead and said, my lawyer, the state knocked off all the white folks and my lawyer didn't do a set there, would that raise it? Is that a sufficient factual matter?
Maybe. I think there just has to be. I think the purpose of that rule in Louisiana is to there's more. The judge doesn't simply want to act on an allegation because they get many, many allegations. If there's some sort of substance to it, they will look into it. They will hold a hearing. They will do something more. But just simply stating offhand is not enough in Louisiana to be fairly presented, and I would argue it's not enough to be heard here in federal court. For all these reasons, I would argue that the district court was correct, and I urge this court to affirm and to deny the petitioner's habeas petition in the entirety. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Chapman, Mr. Kraft?
Very briefly, Your Honor. He says, my right to a jury trial of my peers was violated. I was wrongfully convicted due to ineffective assistance of counsel, who was ill-prepared, and due to that, an all-white jury was selected. So he stated that. Most importantly, he said Sherman Ruth was ill-prepared for a jury trial. He's making reference to events that will be necessarily the horse the record. And that's what post-conviction remedy is all about, an attempt to go outside of the record, an attempt to be allowed to present something. He raised an issue that the court should have been curious about below and should be curious about now, and that merits further development. Secondly,
I don't see how the statement about being ill-prepared for a jury trial relates to the failure to make appropriate peremptory challenges.
I would ask that you look not at my translation on page 12 of my brief, but at the actual excerpt from it, and you see whether, I'm not sure what I said, I interpreted it, and due to an all-white jury selection. I believe that should be read more importantly. It's like due to that, an all-white jury selection. I think he's discussing causation. In any event, he's a pro se petitioner. He's allowed the liberality in the interpretation of his pleadings. Secondly, I'm not sure where Ms. Chapman was going with regard to timing, but I refer to page 7 on my brief. There was a judgment from the First Circuit Court of Appeal affirming the new judgment of the District Court on May 6, 2005, and you find that recorded in a table at 903 Southern 2nd 20, and the post-conviction application was filed on May 9th, 2005. That's 3 days.
The state cited to a state court document in which the state court said that Scott's claim should be dismissed, quote, for failure to specify with reasonable particularity the factual basis for relief. What's in those state court papers? I haven't seen those state court papers that he's referring to.
I have to admit to you, I briefed this case in May of 2009, and although I did see those state court papers, I can't with reliability recite them to you now.
I assume they're in the record.
They're in the record.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr. Kraft. Your case is under submission. We also noticed that you're court appointed, and we thank you for your willingness to take the appointment and for your diligent service on behalf of your client.
Thank you very much.